to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Later in the hour, I'll be talking to a Chico author who was a refugee from Latvia during the Second World War. In 1944, at the age of 18, Zygmunt Vidners resettled first in Germany and then lived in England for many years, eventually coming to the United States. Her memoir is A Branch Without a Tree. Someday I should write a book about my life. Oroville native Marianne Alec heard her mother say these words for years, and when Marianne retired, she wrote that book. She knew she couldn't write about her mother's life without including her father's rich Greek heritage, and she couldn't write their story without going back even further and including their parents. Her memoir, The Liberty Club, covers family stories during World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II. Last week, Marianne Alec told us about her French mother and her French ancestry. Today, I'm going to ask her to tell us about her Greek family and life in historic Oroville, California. Marianne Alec, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, last week you told us about your mother and her growing up in France.
Yes.
And her grandparents, and it was such a fascinating story. And you have all these wonderful photographs throughout your book of your great-grandparents, and they were just such wonderful photographs that I was glad you were able to put them on your cover, and that was your design.
Well, I basically told my editor, who also did the book cover, what I wanted. I went ahead and cropped them and touched them up because some of these are very old photos and they've had creases in them and such, and I tinted them the way I wanted and I sent them all to him. I said, this is what I want, and he made it look even better than I had imagined.
Well, you have different members of your family. Your mother features prominently in the photographs, of course, and you have... tell us more about who are in these photographs.
Yeah, the Liberty Club...
In the center.
The
book
center.
Is called The Liberty Club.
Yeah, sorry.
And the very center of the cover is a matchbook cover.
Yes, it's the one that was used, that they had for that and for the liquor store that you would also read about. And so I wanted to make sure all the pictures were around the Liberty Club. And so I have a picture of... just different pictures. One of them up in the upper right-hand corner is the family in France, and that would have been taken about 1929 or so. And it's when they had tons of money. And then my father in his World War II uniform, that was taken in Germany in 1945 after Hitler, surrendered or died, basically. And then I have my Aunt Colette down underneath the Liberty Club matchbook, which is really cool because I got to see her yesterday. She's still with us.
Well, when I picked up your book and I saw the Liberty Club, I've heard of Liberty Ships, but I didn't know what the Liberty Club was. And once I started reading your book, I thought, oh, that's why she named her book The Liberty Club. So tell the listeners why you named this book The Liberty Club.
It was our family's business. It was a bar.
In?
Downtown Oroville.
Downtown Oroville.
On Montgomery Street. Yes, and it was there for 50 years. And my grandfather, Gus Alec, is the one who started it. And then, of course, it became my father's, Johnny. And they had it for a full 50 years.
Well, since you mentioned Gus and Johnny, these are the Greek side of your family.
Correct.
So I would like to go back to the patriarch of this side of your family. And you have a wonderful photograph of Nicholas, and his last name, in the beginning, is not Alec.
No.
What is his last name that he was born with?
It's our Greek name, Alexou, and it's spelled A-L-E-X-I-O-U.
And why did he change it to Alec?
Well, he didn't change it. It was my grandfather, Gus, his son, who changed it when he came through Ellis Island. And as so many immigrants who came through, they wanted to blend in to America, so they would shorten their name, change their name, which cracks me up. They wanted to be American and sound American, but when you heard them, they obviously had an accent.
So they were Greek.
Yes.
Well, now, on the very beginning of your first chapter, page 2 in your book, there is this wonderful photograph of your great-grandparent, Nicholas.
Mm-hmm.
And if when you look at that photograph, there's one thing that stands out.
Oh, totally. His mustache, his handlebar mustache, which in looking at the picture, it had to have been 10 inches long, you know, 5 inches from the center. I mean,
and it didn't droop. It was not a drooping mustache.
Oh, no. He had it waxed and, you know, just perfect sticking out. So, yeah.
He's a nice-looking gentleman, and I imagine he must have had a sense of humor to wear a mustache like that.
I would think so.
So, this patriarch of the family, your great-grandfather, had the Greek name.
Mm-hmm.
So why did his son, and when did his son become Gus Alec?
Well,
instead, what was his name he was born with?
Konstantinos Alexou.
Isn't that a great Greek name?
I know. I love it. I do.
But he thought it was kind of a mouthful for Americans, so he became...
I'm sure. Yeah, he just became Gus Alec.
And he even thought at one time about becoming a priest, did he not?
He did, in his homeland. He was actually studying to become a priest, and my father told me that he remembers him having volumes of Greek Orthodox teachings and books, and a lot of the men used to sit around, and I don't even include this in the book because I have so much information, and they used to sit around and talk about the religion and exchange stories and their thoughts and views, and he remembers them doing that.
So Gus, or Konstantinos,
mm-hmm.
comes to America, and at what point did he change his name?
Through Ellis Island.
Ellis Island. That
Oh, yes.
is just a classic way that immigrants entered this country.
Yes. Yes, that's when he did it. So
your grandfather came to the United States, and he comes as a single man.
Mm-hmm.
So how is he going to meet a wife? How is he going to get a wife here,
yes.
this young man?
Well, he waited a while.
And he actually wasn't that young when he got married.
No, he was 33. He waited a while. He did it right. You know, he established his business. He had money in his pocket. He was doing very well. And that's when he decided he wanted to take on a wife.
Well, now, last week you told us about the arranged marriage on your mother's side of the family.
Yes.
And what happened then on your father's side of the family?
It was basically the same thing. My grandfather, Gus, had a gentleman that worked for him. And, of course, you don't know until you read it that he acquired a business called the Oro Vista Hotel. He bought it. No, he started it, him and a partner. And that was back
and
in 19...
This is in Oroville.
In Oroville on Montgomery Street.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this was back in 1914. And so this gentleman he had worked...
So your family has a really long history in Oroville.
Oh, yes.
They were responsible for a lot of the building up of this town.
Oh,
literally.
Yes, because he was in construction.
Yeah.
Yes.
So he has this employee,
mm-hmm.
and you were telling us now how this connection, how...
Yes, John Stefanis. And John Stefanis came also over from Greece with the last name. You can tell he's Greek, full-blooded. And he had two daughters who lived still in the old country. And so he says, it was slim pickings. I mean, there was not very many available Greek women in Oroville. And he was determined to marry into, you know, a Greek wife. So he went all the way back to Greece, John did, and...
The father of these two daughters.
Correct. And he brought one of them back.
But it wasn't the one he thought he was going to bring back.
No, because the oldest daughter, Anastasia, had the measles. And back then, you know, you're just not going to travel under those conditions. And so the younger daughter, they switched the pictures because they originally were going to send the one of Anastasia, so they sent the one of Angelica.
And Gus didn't know either one of them anyway,
no,
so it wouldn't have mattered to him. I mean,
no,
either
it,
one.
Yeah, I just want, she has to be Greek.
Right.
Exactly, prerequisite. So it was arranged in that my grandmother basically was like, oh, okay, you know, I'll go along with what Dad says, whereas Gus at least was able to say, yes, I want to marry, you know.
Yeah, and when you look at the photographs, they're wonderful photographs of this young couple. Well, he was 33, she was 23.
Correct.
And she doesn't really look all that happy, Marianne.
No, she does not. She does not, and she probably wasn't, I mean, when you think about it.
Well, we have this group of Greeks living in Oroville, and did you ever find out why Oroville?
Well, a lot of it had to do, according to my father, was the climate. He said that the climate of Oroville was very much like their homeland. And because of that, a lot of the Greeks came over, and, you know, they networked. You know, you talked to other Greeks, and it got back to where this was a good place. Because they liked to live in the same area, so you had a camaraderie. And so a lot of the Greeks chose Oroville.
And they could make olives and wine.
Oh, thank you. Yes, yes, yes. The olive trees, Mission olive trees, were abundant. And my grandfather also used to cure his own, or he used to make olive oil. Then my grandmother used to cure the olives that, oh, my God, they were so good.
I happen to be a fan of Greek olives in particular, Mary.
Oh, the Kalamatas. So, me too.
Or just black olives. Yes. Don't even have to be Kalamata olives. Gus comes through Ellis Island. He comes to Oroville, 1906.
Mm-hmm.
And then Nicholas really didn't live to be that old.
No. No, he didn't. He passed away just a few years after my grandfather came, and thankfully he was at his side when he passed away, so he did have family. And that was back in 1910 that he passed away, Nicholas.
Nicholas, then,
yes.
The patriarch.
Correct.
My guest is Marianne Alec, and her book is The Liberty Club. It is a family memoir, and last week, to kind of keep things straight, make it easy to follow, we talked about, the conversation was about your mother's side of the family and what was happening in France.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just been talking about now what's going on here in Oroville.
Mm-hmm.
And so where do these two stories come together?
Well, they come together during World War II, which is when my Greek father, Johnny, meets my mother, French mother, Monique. And it was during the war, during the liberation of Nice, which is, of course, in the south of France, for those of you who don't know.
Well, now, the photographs of your father, Johnny, my goodness, what a handsome, he looks like a movie star in his photographs.
I have a friend who said that she used to see my parents, she's a little older than me, she would see my parents in Oroville when she was younger, and she thought they were movie stars. Yeah, they were knockouts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this young soldier comes into Nice, and I guess I just, in my imagination, he knocks on the door where Monique is and said, ma'am, can I hang some communications wire here? Because that was his job.
Correct.
He was a paratrooper.
Yes, he was.
But his job was in communications.
Correct. Yes. And it was love at first sight. It truly was. And it was very interesting because he was also drunk. because it was the liberation of Nice. And they call it the champagne campaign for a reason. Because, you know, break out the bottles.
The hard part was over.
Yes, it's time to rest and you know, relax and enjoy the French beauty, so to speak. And yes, that was what was happening. So he shows up, it's still morning, he's drunk, he's, you know, looking to string his lines up. And actually, my mother had been downstairs and saw him. And he was going to string them in the line in the balcony below, but he wasn't able to, and that's in the book. Mm-hmm. So anyway, my mother offered, seeing him, and thought, oh, he's a cutie, you know, to herself.
Plus, she had been so bored, and she was really just looking for love and hoping it would come her way, and there is this handsome Greek soldier.
Exactly. And so they go up to the balcony, and they, you know, do their thing. And his partner, James Batten, is someone that my brother Greg was able to actually talk to years later, and get some stories from him, which are in the book, firsthand accounts. And he said, after my dad came back from stringing the lines and after he had talked to this French gal, you know, my mom.
Who was a teenager at the time.
Who was a teenager, correct. She was 17, I believe, at the time. He said that was it for Johnny. It was like after that, you know, that was who his sights were on.
Well, one thing that I wondered about as I was reading your book, too, now, it makes sense that they would put Johnny in communications. I mean, he spoke Greek, so he had facility with another language.
Mm-hmm.
But your mother spoke French, and your dad English and Greek. How did they communicate with each other?
I think, you know, love is a universal language, I believe.
And so that was no barrier to
No, it was not. No, I think that my dad was able to pick up enough. And my mother actually picked up on English very quickly. very quickly, to the point where, I mean, she became...
Strong motivation on both their parts.
Definitely, definitely, yes.
So. My guest is Marianne Alick, and her book is The Liberty Club, and the book takes its title from a bar that was in Oroville for many, many years, and since your family was in construction, the Greek side of your family, they really built much of Oroville.
Yes, well, Gus, yes.
Gus did, yeah. So their son goes off to France, mm-hmm. falls in love with this young woman, but they can't get married right away.
Well, no, there's a war still going on. It's not over. And so he has to, you know, go on, and he goes up into the Maritime Alps, and he's doing their fighting there. And I have some wonderful pictures of him up in during World War II during that time. And, you know, back then you didn't have the communication, and plus it was war. You just didn't know what was going on. Every day she could think he died. So it was very tough.
In fact, he minimized it in his letters. He didn't want her to worry, so he made her think everything's fine,
oh,
I'm
yes.
doing just great.
Yes.
And you have so much detail in your book that just were delightful. For example, what was your dad's best haircut when he was in the Army?
Oh, my gosh. When he first came over, before he was in, when he first came to Africa, then before he went into France and Anzio, he also fought in Anzio, he went down the street and somebody had this really great haircut.
And this is North Africa. It's not like Paris where you might find a good hair
yes.
cutter.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, North Africa.
And so he asked the guy where he got it from. So he took him down to this place, and he walks in, and he sees this guy with this comb, this metal comb wrapped in leather, and these hot pokers. And he was actually burning and shaping the hair of the soldier that was sitting in his chair. And he says it just smelled so bad, and he had incense burning everywhere. But he said it was the best haircut he had ever gotten.
You know, I'm wondering, as you're saying this, it's not exactly a haircut, it's a hair burn.
It's a hair burn, yes.
And then when they were in Italy, they had time for opera. That was a surprise.
I know, yes. The Marriage of Figaro. He saw that with his buddies. I had no idea. My brother John knew that because he had shared that with my brother. And... yeah, who knew?
Because we think at wartime everything is...
shut down.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And then there was also something that was kind of unsettling. I think if I had been in his shoes, and I don't know if I knew this or just never thought about it, but convicts here in the United States, if they wanted early parole, they could exchange that by going into the Army.
That's correct.
So your dad is elbow to elbow with
yes,
convicts.
That's correct. Yes. He was in some circumstances, and they were ruthless. They did things that today would be considered war crimes, but you know, people didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, it did not set well with my father, but at the same time, he feared them just as much.
I would think so.
Yeah, it's like, well, God, if I tell on them, what are they going to do to me?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I say mm-hmm. in the book what they did, but you know, I'm not going to say it here. You have to read the book.
The Germans were the enemy, but still,
yes.
Your dad, for example, when he shot a German soldier in the stomach, he took that young
yes.
man to the medics.
Yes, yeah, and he caught hell for it because they're
he's the enemy, and your
yes.
dad's taking care of. But he's a human being,
exactly, and he saw him eye to eye. You know, they
yeah.
came around the bush, and they both raised their rifles, and my dad got the shot off first. Well. You know, he's compassionate.
Yeah.
You know, he's like 17, 18 years old. I mean, come on. And he drug him back to camp, and they fixed him up. And he lived, and he probably was very grateful.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so your dad has this compassion, and he is a soldier in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And... we think, oh, he went to opera, and he's seeing this young French woman. Everything sounds fine. But he was in one of the worst battles
mm-hmm.
of the whole
yes.
Second World War. Yeah. And you give statistics of how many dead and wounded, and it's just staggering. Staggering.
And especially since it was for such a short time.
You know, in such a short time,
yeah.
how many dead and wounded there were. Yeah. And you realize how fortunate your dad was to live through that.
Well, especially at St. Vith, which he was a member of the 509 PIB, which is a parachute infantry battalion. And they were kind of like the first Green Beret, you know?
Yeah.
They really were. And because they
except
would
they got awarded a Red Beret.
Yes, exactly, right.
So what battle are we talking about, by the way? I don't know if I mentioned the Battle of the Bulge.
The Battle of the Bulge, correct.
Yeah, because they were celebrating thinking, okay, this war is pretty much locked up.
Yes.
We're pretty much done.
Yes.
And they didn't know the Germans had one more in December of all times the year.
And it was the worst winter. I mean, it even had snowed in Nice.
In Nice. I noticed that.
Yes.
Snow in Nice. That's very rare.
Which I knew because of my mother's journal.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I might mention that you told us this last week, but that your mother, you had access to a journal that your mother kept that was invaluable in knowing what happened and how they felt about it, how she felt about it.
Right. Plus my dad's love letters.
Oh, yes. And you said there were over 100 of these letters.
The binder, I'm not kidding, it's like 2.5 to 3 inches thick. I put them all in numerical sequence before I started, you know, going through
chronological.
I'm sorry, chronological, yes, so that I could follow what was happening. And
Well, people, and this is a very, it's a number two hobby in the United States, people wanting to learn about their families and their ancestry. And how fortunate you were to have this material. So you have all these letters between your mother and your dad. And mostly it was because they were missing each other?
Oh, yes, definitely.
But then there was one letter that your dad wrote. Here's this compassionate man, and just how could he write that to him? Because by that point they were married.
Yes, after they were married. Yeah, there's a twist. There's a twist I won't give away that is in the book, yes, that you will find. But things worked out, obviously, because they stayed together. But, yeah, there was definitely a twist.
Yeah, because he was able to come back to the United States after they were married, but paperwork, and it took a while for her to be able to.
Well, there was a lot going on. Yeah, there was a lot of turmoil, a lot of turmoil.
Well, at one point in one of your mother's letters, I was struck. She says, it is raining in my heart. And one of my favorite poems in French is by Paul Verlaine. C'est il pleure dans mon cœur comme il pleure sur la ville. And it's raining in my heart. The verb that she usually uses is crying. Mm-hmm. It's crying in my heart like it's raining on the city. And when I see rain on a kind of a gray day, I think of that poem. And I thought, oh, your mother is quoting this poem by Paul Verlaine. It's in English in your book.
Yes.
But I thought of the words in French that she's saying. Oh, it's...
I wasn't even aware of that.
It's crying in my heart. My heart is crying like it's raining in my heart. And they're just such touching letters between the two of them. Because it was unpredictable. They didn't know when they would get...
Well, she even at that one time had sent a message to the Salvation Army because she hadn't heard from him for about 5 weeks. Which, you know, was way too long.
And I thought it was very nice that she got a reply.
She
because
did.
That kind of surprised me. I'm thinking, boy, they're probably getting a lot of letters of women who are wondering about their sons or their fathers or their brothers or husbands in this case. And they actually had a nice letter back. And what did it say?
It was written in both in French and in English. And it said that he was not listed as a casualty. That's how they put it. And then 3 days later, she did get a letter from him. But during that time, she was just, you know, frantic, like, oh, is he alive? And then she knew that the Battle of the Bulge had taken place. She knew that there was the big, as she puts it, the big battle in the Ardennes, and which is where it took place. They didn't name it yet, you know, in the Battle of the Bulge at that time. And so she was just, you know, did he die? I mean, so many died.
My guest is Marianne Alec, and her book, her family memoir, is The Liberty Club. And her parents then, once they were married, and got back to the United States. And your family had this bar called the Liberty Club in Oroville. And that was, your dad was, tell us what your dad's role was in the Liberty Club.
You know, he was kind of a caretaker in a way, because these patrons became his downtown family. He really did care about them. He was very compassionate, and my grandfather Gus as well. And one of the things that he did, which was I learned from my brother John, because he's 10 years older than me, so he knows a lot more, thankfully. My dad, a lot of these men were pretty hard drinkers. It was a bar. You know, it's a working man's bar. And so in order for them to still maintain a roof over their heads, my dad would cash their checks. And they became the bank for a lot of these people who didn't have checking accounts. They wouldn't cash their checks at a regular bank. They cashed it there at my dad's bar. And so he would hold back a portion and give allowances to about six of these patrons so that they wouldn't drink it all in, you know, 2 days. Mm-hmm. And they would still have a roof over their head and still have meals. And he basically did this year after year for many of these men who would have ended up on the streets. And then a lot of them also lived upstairs in the Oro Vista Hotel that my grandparents had. So,
and how many years are we talking about now, the Liberty Club?
30s to the 80s. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
From the 1930s to the 1980s.
38 to 88, I think it was. Or 37 to 87. Mm-hmm.
So that's quite a mm-hmm. long life for any business.
Oh, yeah.
And particularly something like that, a bar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you have photographs in your book of when then the Liberty Club was dismantled.
Yes. Yeah. It's very sad for our family. Yeah.
I can imagine. Because your dad, he made the front page of the paper on more than one occasion.
Oh, yes.
One, the anniversary of, because of his role in World War II, mm-hmm. an anniversary comes up and they put his picture on the front page because he was really a war hero.
Your dad really was
a war hero.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was actually in twice, once for Anzio and once for the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So he had the front page for the Battle of the Bulge when the 50th anniversary
yes.
came up.
Yes.
And then another time when he made the paper was maybe not so
Yeah,
happy.
he got knocked out by one of the patrons there. He wasn't a regular. He came in the bar drunk. You know, my dad told him to leave. He wouldn't, and he ended up hitting my dad before my dad even knew it, and they had to take him away, you know, on the gurney, and the guy was handcuffed and taken
away. In fact, you have a photograph of your dad being rolled on a gurney.
Yes, yeah. I did a lot of research.
You did, and you had so much material there that you had the journal that your mother wrote, you mm-hmm. had the letters between your parents, mm-hmm. you had recordings
yes.
that older family members made for you.
John did, yes.
Yeah, your older brother mm-hmm. did that, who was named the same name as your dad.
Yes, yeah.
And so you had access to, and then you got papers and documents that you reproduce in your book, too, mm-hmm. that you had access to. So I'm just amazed that you were able to accomplish all that in just 3 years.
It was a lot. Well, I was, you know, I just didn't stop. I was obsessed. I mean, I really was. I was obsessed. And I just like, it was fun. It really was. It was like, oh, my God. You know, you'd find these things like, oh, check this out, you know, and I'd share it with my family and emails and stuff.
Because you found out things that your family didn't know. Not only did you not know, but other members of your family didn't know.
Correct. Nobody knew except for, you know, the people that lived it during the time.
Now, eventually your mother passed away, mm-hmm. but I would like to not go into that because it's heartbreaking for any of us to lose a family member, and particularly mm-hmm. someone like your mother. I hope people will have a chance to pick up your book because it's not just about your family. It's about all of us
yes.
who have families, which is all of us.
Most of us come from immigrants, you know, and
yeah.
all stories are about family. About people.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you,
Marianne,
about your book. And we're going to be taking a break. And after a short break, I'll be talking to Latvian native Zigrid Vidners about her memoir, A Branch Without a Tree, which recounts her experiences as a teenage refugee after World War II. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio.
My guest today was a refugee from Latvia during the Second World War who escaped Stalin's troops by fleeing to Germany. Sigrid Vidners found herself at the age of 18 with no home, no country, and no future, a branch torn off a tree. She wrote about her childhood in Latvia in her first book, I Grew Up in Latvia. She chronicles frightening times and hardships in her new book, A Branch Without a Tree. Sigrid Vidners, welcome. Now, you also wrote a children's book. I think it was about 1944. It started, Once Upon a Time, There Was a Little Girl Called Mara.
Yes, yes, I remember. That was my first response to being away and being, you know, full of hurt. And, of course, I was sick with my broken, not torn, knee. So I needed something to do, and I wrote that little story.
And you say it turned out to be your story.
Well, yes, that's what it became, of the little girl being taken across the sea and then, you know, having to go through kind of degrading situations, and but always dreaming and hoping to get back there.
Well, I would like to start your story then. On June the 17th of 1940, you were 14 years old.
Yes.
And what happened in Latvia?
Well, the Russian army walked in. And, of course, I didn't know any of the politics behind, because the Russians already had requested the ports in Latvia. And they were already established there. And then, all of a sudden, in the middle of next summer, the Russian troops walked in, just walked in. And I was just terrified, And a kind of doom came over me. I knew it wouldn't be good, and it wasn't. It was terrible.
So their occupation lasted a year.
Yes.
And then the Germans came in July of 1941.
Yes.
And there, you mentioned in your book, this is ironic, because the Germans were your lifelong enemies.
Yes.
They had enslaved Latvians for 700 years.
Yes.
And yet you felt that the Germans saved you from the Russians.
Well, they did. They did, very factually, because they found lists of deportations only 2 weeks later. So if they had come later, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be alive today.
So. And yet, from American point of view, since the Soviets were fighting on our side in World War II,
yes.
We think of, okay, the Soviets were the good guys, the Germans were the bad guys. But you say that the communists, well, if they were both equal or both evil, and you say the communists were much more evil than the Nazis.
They were. They were. And see, the world doesn't even know it today. Because what they did, how many people they killed within that 1 year and deported tens of thousands of people to Siberia. Anybody who was anybody was the enemy of the state, had to be eradicated. A lot of the, you know, people from university and people like that. And it was just terrible. Would we now think, would we flee to the warring Germany at war, to escape from Russians if they hadn't been that bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But because of that experience of that 1 year when so many bad things happened and nobody knew who will be next, so that was the only way for a lot of people who, you know, owned some property or were in some kind of a position in government or elsewhere.
Was to escape to Germany.
Yes.
My guest is Sigrid Vidners. She lives in Chico now, but she is telling the story of how she felt like a branch without a tree. This is the name of her newest book. So how did you get from Latvia to Germany?
We were evacuated. But thinking now, it was probably, perhaps they wouldn't have done it even, but they drew our men into their army, They had to go. They were prevented from it by Geneva Convention. But to do that, they made the people, the men, to sign that they went of their free will.
And one of those men was your father.
Yes, yes, my father and my brother.
And your
my
brother.
My oldest brother, mm-hmm. both of them, yes.
Were drafted into the German army.
That's right.
Although they made it appear that they joined of their own free will.
Yes, and that was, I think that was why they felt obligated to help those people to get out. Perhaps not. That's just my assessment now.
Well, so you have an older brother and your father are drafted into the German army.
Correct.
And you have a younger brother,
yes.
younger than you.
Yeah.
You and your mother have an opportunity then to flee to Germany.
Yes.
And where were you going to live when you got to Germany?
Well, we really, they asked for a destination, but we didn't know anybody. And so we used an address that my uncle had gotten from, he was a chauffeur for the Gebietskommissar in his town. And he had said, if any of your relatives have to flee, this is the place, good place to go to. His hometown, Husum, in Schleswig-Holstein. Because he said there's no war industry of any kind. It's just a rural country with
farms. So therefore you would be a target for the bombs if you're in an area that's not producing war material.
Absolutely, because many, those who went to the large cities, they were more in danger than we were.
So you and your mother and your brother find yourself in this refugee camp.
Not at first. We go to Husum, and there we are handled by Red Cross ladies, and they were supposed to find jobs for us, for those who could work because, you know, of the war and all that. And they sent us to a farm, and that was a very, very traumatic experience for me because I was supposed to work on a farm, which wouldn't be so bad. I worked on our farm in Latvia.
Because your family had a farm, and
yes.
you were there in the summertime.
Yes, but this was a totally different approach, especially it ended very badly. I'm glad that I didn't have to be there long.
But and your mother wasn't in very good health herself. She'd had tuberculosis.
That's right, and she was supposed to work in bakery. And after a day or two, my mother said, I can't do that. And my brother was supposed to work there too. He was 12. He needed to go to school. So there again, I can thank the Germans that they handled us very well, at least where we were. Because the burgomaster or the head of the little village, he found us different lodgings somewhere else to live. And at the bakery, the living quarters were just beyond anything. You know, I have described it in the book, living in an attic without any heating or anything and winter coming on.
In fact, that was a real problem. I don't think those of us who have nice warm homes in the wintertime give a thought to how difficult that is. When resources, fuel is scarce?
Well, it was. It was for everybody, yes. Mm-hmm. But there was, I mean, it had been some kind of storage area. There were no real walls or, you know, I could see through it.
Where you were staying with in this tiny space with your mother and brother.
So we were not long in that situation because it just, well, I had to stay with a farmer, but... Well, at first, it was a struggle to go and work, knowing that Germans had used our people for centuries as their slaves or their
and that's what you were
their servants, and then now I would be doing that for them. That was a great struggle with.
The men they put to work as being soldiers, and the wives and children were put to work, like you say, on a farm, your mother in a bakery.
Yeah.
So then when you eventually go to a refugee camp.
Yes.
And what were conditions like in the refugee camp?
Yeah, well, that was after the war.
Yeah.
We were collected by
Yeah, during the war, you were slaves, yeah, more or less. Yeah, German slaves.
Yeah, wherever anybody could find where to stay. But after the war, we were put in camps by this UNRWA, United Nations Refugee Relief Association, or I'm not quite sure.
Well, people might be wondering, Sigrid, well, if the war is over, why don't you go back to Latvia?
Well, my goodness, can we? You see, our Latvia was given away already. It was given away, and that was the bitterest pill to swallow. And yet, for years after that, even after we went to England, the hope remained that something might change, something might change. Because it wasn't only that we were not there, but we were hurting for the people who were there, left there, and were subjected to all the cruelties that we had fled from.
And I don't think many people know about this.
Yes.
And the Russians, after the war, were trying to coax you back. Those of you,
yes,
who had been refugees, well, come back to Latvia.
Yes.
And yet you found out, and I don't know what point you found out, how many thousands were arrested, Latvians, arrested,
yeah,
and taken to Siberia.
Well, that was before we left. See, that's why we left. But they had other deportations in 49 when they deported 40,000 people.
Four years after the war, 1949,
yeah.
They're deporting people.
Yeah, from the farms to get them move from their lands and to go into the collective farms, which they were advertising.
My guest is Sigrid Vidners, and she has written a book, A Branch Without a Tree, because this is how she felt. She felt like a branch without a tree. And Sigrid, this is a paragraph from your book when you are talking about going for a walk in the forest. And you say, I walked and walked under the golden canopies with the red and gold leaves thick under my feet and the broken branches lying on the ground this way and that. As I waded through them, I thought how they too were broken off their trees, the same as I was broken off the tree of my nation. But they accepted what had to be, and I knew that I also had to learn to accept what had to be. I came across an old tree stump overgrown with green moss, but at its side a new sprightly shoot had come up, a new little tree. There would be a new life, a new living. That thought made me so glad. It was a promise. But that promise was a long time in coming. You had a lot more to go through.
Well, see, that promise has not been fulfilled. Although we survived, we learned to accept and all that, it still hurts inside that it had to happen, that it had to happen to my people, and also that I couldn't live with my family there. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's the world is.
Well, we were talking about the situation in the camps and that your brother was, as a 12-year-old, he needed to go to school.
Yes.
So what were the accommodations for school children in Germany, in the refugee camp?
Just barracks. We all lived in barracks in very tight situations, one small room for family. And when my brother came back from the prisoner of war camp, then there were four of us in this tiny room, but it had to do.
So the war had ended. You,
yes,
your mother, and your younger brother were in the refugee camp.
Yes.
Your older brother, not right away, not at the very end of the war, after a delay, he was able to join you.
Yes.
He'd been in a prisoner of war camp.
Yes.
But you didn't know. You hadn't heard about your dad.
No.
Where is Dad?
Dad, well, we found out really some news, and then again some news, and in the end that he had been captured on the last day before the capitulation.
Yet that just, I want people to hear that.
Yes.
The day before.
Yes.
Just the day before.
It was so terrible. And
he
came to visit us in that little village on New Year's Eve, just for one night.
You were hoping for Christmas.
We were hoping for Christmas, but he came for New Year that night, and then he told us, and he said, oh, there are news that they will let go the older officers because they were supposed to instruct the young, the young people coming into the army. And he said, we don't have any armament. What can you train? How can you train? So they had to dig trenches in the wintertime, in their summer clothes, and without, so painful, so very painful. And he said, well, maybe I'll be back soon. So we were expecting him, and war ended, and we were waiting for him. And everybody came, and he didn't, and we didn't have to go anywhere. So it was a terrible feeling.
Well, you know what, too? You say in your book that you injured your knee pretty badly.
Yes.
But one thing that it turned out that perhaps if you had not had that knee injury, you wouldn't have gotten to see your father that one last time.
That's right, because they weren't giving any free time for anybody at that Christmas. And yet he had received my mother's letter telling about my injury, and he got the...
And he had to travel a long way to get there.
Yes, well,
he almost had to turn around and go back.
Well, that's how it was. He arrived about noon on New Year's Eve and left next morning. So, yeah, you asked me what happened to him. Well, we found out that he had been captured and had gone through all those filtration camps, which had been terrible, terrible, nasty, as I found out later on. And he was sent to Ural Mountains to some stone mines to work for 10 years for, you know, having been in German army.
But all this you didn't know for a very long time.
No. And then only 3 years later, I found that he had survived 3 years and he had died there.
My guest is Sigrid Vidners, and her book is A Branch Without a Tree. And she lived in a refugee camp in Germany. And you described, this was before you went to the refugee camp, actually, that when you were living in Germany, that the teacher, when you were in a student, you were in the classroom. As the teacher came into the classroom, we all had to rise to our feet, which you had done in Latvia, in schools in Latvia.
Yes.
So that was
courtesy.
Okay. But you also had to raise your right arm and say, Heil Hitler. And then the teacher would reply, Heil Hitler.
Yes.
And then you'd be seated. And whatever you or anybody else felt about this didn't matter. This was the way it had to be, and you didn't want to get things complicated because there would be serious consequences. There were large posters on the wall everywhere showing this shadowy figure with a finger on his lips and a text that said, the enemy is listening in. And it, you say it reminded you of the Russian communist regime, which you'd had for that 1 year in Latvia. And you get to Germany, and you're reminded of the way the Russians, the Soviets, had treated you when you were still in Latvia.
Yes.
So you had left and gone to the refugee camp, and heating was a problem, trying to stay warm. What about, how did they feed you in this refugee camp?
Well, it was a communal kitchen, and so they served a warm meal at midday. And in the mornings and evenings, we could go to the kitchen and get some hot water for some coffee or tea or whatever to drink. And then on Fridays, we were given out rations for the next week. And those were not too great.
Well, and you say that was, it wasn't very good in the beginning even. And you say once a week, you'd stand in line for your weekly rations, which were half a loaf of bread per person, a little margarine, about 3 tablespoons, a small lump of fish conserves, about 4 tablespoons, a small glob of jam, about 2 tablespoons, and that was it. It had to do for the week.
Yes.
But
then
things got even worse.
Yes, they did.
Germany was having a hard time feeding anybody, and you say that you didn't even get any bread then. In almost 3 weeks, you were talking about how you felt, and you'd been 2 years, 2 years as refugees.
Yes,
And that you just, sometimes you describe, you say your heart felt so heavy.
Well, wouldn't yours?
Oh,
wouldn't
yeah.
yours?
Oh, yeah.
And that was tough because they somehow, I don't know why, but they didn't have the bread, and they brought us these dog biscuits. At least I'm sure they were, because you just couldn't choose them. They were so hard that your gums would bleed if you did, and so had to go without.
You know. So the way you get out of the refugee camp, though, is that you are offered the opportunity to go to England. And people might wonder, well, why England? Why not France? Or why not the United States? Maybe they don't remember that Germany was divided into sectors, and
yes,
it happened that you were in the sector that the,
yes,
British were in charge of.
Yes, and I can add here that I have learned later that they had it much better in the camps in the American zone. They didn't have this, you know, at least as bad as we had it.
So how did you manage to, and how did you even have the courage? I mean, you're a young person. You're just in your late teens. How did you make that break from your family to say, okay, they're offering me this opportunity to go to England? How did you arrive at that decision?
Well, they came to the camp, and they advertised and asked healthy young women who could work in hospitals that they could apply only. So I was the only one who was able to, you know, take advantage of this. And I didn't want to go, but my older brother kept talking to me every day. Oh, sis, you know, it'll be bad here in Germany for a long time yet, and why don't you go, and then you can help us too. And so I kind of got
so that you could be more help to them there in England than you could if you had stayed in the camp.
That's right, because the situation was so bad in the camp. And at first they didn't, they said that I had some problem with my lungs, that I couldn't go. And then they had another check out a few weeks later, and then they said that I could. So I was just...
So what was your commitment then? They say they'd like you to come work in the hospital. So what was to keep you from saying, okay, now I'm here, I'll go do what I want to do? What was your commitment to the British?
Well, they wanted us to... I don't remember if we had to sign, most likely, but the contract would be for 3 years, that we had to work government-appointed jobs. But, of course, later people just moved out of it and there was no hindrance. But
well, people might also wonder, well, Sigrid, did you speak English? I mean, here you're going to be working in England. Did you speak the language?
Well, I did, sort of as a school kid, school English, but at least I knew some. And we had a very good English teacher in grade school who just talked English to us. She had just come back from England from training, and so I learned a lot then. So there was a beginning, but then reading...
Well, actually, when you got there, too, and somebody in the street talks to you, and they're speaking, you call it Brum.
Brum, yeah.
And then, did that make you a little insecure? But, well, I thought I knew English, but I can't understand this guy.
Well, this is it. We tried to figure out, we're looking at some flowers, and we love flowers, would love to have some. Of course, we didn't have the money, but we wanted to know how much it was. And there the woman said something, and we didn't understand. And we asked again, and she started getting kind of funny. You know, what's going on here?
For one thing, it was the dialect.
Yeah.
And the other, it was the complicated monetary system, shillings and guineas and farthings, yeah, and halfpenny. And
yeah, well, the way they pronounced them. That was the difference. If they had said two pennies or three pennies, it would have
you
been
could
all right.
That.
Yeah, but they said tuppence and threepence and tenner. And what's a tenner? It's sixpence. Well, so a lot of learning.
Well, while you are in England, you turn 21.
Yes.
And the work you were doing, by the way, I mean, people say, oh, she's going to work in a hospital. Maybe she'll be a nursing assistant. No, that was not what you were doing. You talk about it being a slave.
We were there for hard labor, and it was hard labor. I think we were doing man's job because polishing those floors every morning with that big, heavy bumper, there were no machines. no sweeping or no vacuuming or nothing. No dishwashing machines.
You were that dishwasher.
I was the dishwasher and I was the sweeper.
But you impressed them because you and there were three other women, young woman, more or less your age, did your job so well that they could not believe, because they were used to some Irish young girls who could care less whether they did a good job.
Yeah.
And you were very conscientious about having a clean floor. And so you impressed the hierarchy.
Yeah.
Here's a young woman who really wants to do a good job.
But you know, it was for ourselves as well. And I think more for ourselves, at least for me. I can't say for others. But it was that repaying yourself for a job well done, however hard it was a duty and it had to be performed as perfectly as possible. So that was kind of uplifting thought that I have done a good job, however menial.
My guest is Sigrid Vidners. She lives in Chico now, but she grew up in Latvia, in Germany, and now she is telling us how she was scrubbing floors in a hospital in England, and it happened to be that you went to Birmingham is where you were. And then on your 21st birthday, they were working you very hard, but they said, okay, Sigrid, you can have the afternoon off.
Oh, what a gift.
And so you had, and I'm so glad you made the decision because you decided to get your photograph taken and you include it in your book, this beautiful young woman on her 21st birthday and this beautiful blouse. And I showed my husband, I said, look at this blouse. And tell the listeners what your blouse was made of.
It was a parachute silk. My mother had got some, and I drew threads up here on the yoke and embroidered it. And
it was beautiful. Blouse.
Yeah,
I showed my husband, and I said, Sigrid did that. You see that embroidery across the top of that blouse? She did that.
Yeah, it's like lace.
It is. It was a lovely photograph.
Yeah. See, in those days, we made whatever we needed. We tried to make ourselves because there was nowhere to buy them. So,
in fact, you liked folk dancing. Folk dancing played a big role in your life. And when it came to costumes, you had to figure out how to find the materials to make these costumes.
Yeah, that was the hardest thing.
But all along through your book, you kept asking yourself, what is life all about? What is this life? And you were digging for these answers. And those of us who are reading your book, it causes us to examine our own lives, to look at what your life was like and how you managed as you went through these really hard times. I want listeners to know that your story has a happy ending. It's not really an ending, but a lot of doctors wanted to kiss you under the mistletoe at Christmas time, and you'd had none of that. But you do meet this wonderful young man who is from Latvia himself, and I will let the readers find out how your story continues, how you do find that happiness that you were looking for. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Sigrid.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy.
I'd also like to thank my first guest, Marianne Alec, whose family memoir is The Liberty Club. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.